Welcome to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant. The Legacy and Faith Show is about the journey of discovering how to create plans that protect wealth and family values for generations. And now the host of the Legacy and Faith Show, Paul Grant.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, it's the Legacy and Faith Show with estate and tax planning attorney Paul Grant. Hello, Mr. Grant, once again.
Great to be with you, as always.
Good to see you. Hey, I'm excited because we're going to be wrapping up the estate planning life cycle this week. This has been a very informative series.
Great. And yes, we are wrapping up the estate planning life cycle. It's been a series kind of discussing exactly what does it mean to have an estate plan. And I think most people don't have the concept that an estate plan can actually begin to wear out, become less and less efficient. So we need to be concerned, and we need to be thinking about where we are individually in this thing called a life cycle of estate planning. And so why don't we take a quick review here of the different steps?
Yeah, well, we've gotten through the first seven stages. The first one was the exploration and education.
And the exploration and education session is really about what does it mean to look at estate planning and get really good, relevant knowledge so you can make accurate choices for your family.
Mm-hmm. Number two is engage and create or counseling.
That's right. And so with counseling, we need someone else's voice. We need someone with experience to lead us through the proper questions so that nothing is missed.
Number three was financial integration.
The financial integration is whenever we create a plan, we need to ensure that our accounts, our finances, our homes, everything that we own link in and properly will walk out the journey that the estate plan has now created.
Number four, continuation commitment.
That is the continuation commitment is the idea of having relationship with your estate planner. So in other words, most estate planners are a document producers. Here's your document. But our encouragement is this specific area of law needs to have a relationship and you need to be continually involved in your plan to make it work properly.
Number five was the family reception.
Family reception is the thought process of instead of just creating a plan that transfers wealth, in other words, from the creator's perspective of getting wealth to the hands of the beneficiaries, we want to look at it as wealth reception as well, which is, are our beneficiaries, is the family ready to receive exactly what we're leaving behind?
Number six was the life adjustments.
Life adjustments are the concerns that as we continue to age, we don't know what tomorrow holds. And so therefore, the plan needs to be strong enough. And that kind of almost goes back to the relationship, the continuation commitment of having relationships so we can make sure that with each different stage of life, that the estate plan is constantly being adjusted to meet that need.
And number seven last time was the settlement system.
And the settlement system is what happens when someone does die. So what's the process? What are the steps that each one of us needs to be thinking about, regardless of whether we use a will or a trust? We need to make sure we understand the steps involved in order to close an estate.
Mm-hmm. All these programs can be heard at legacyandfaith.com. All these podcasts, you can hear the entire series. Bringing us up to number eight, which is actually a two-parter, legacy fulfillment. With the surviving spouse, care and security for that person, and also heir security. So we're going to kind of flesh that out this week.
That's right. So legacy fulfillment. Look, we create an estate plan with the intention of something very specifically happening. Now, I don't know what that thing is or what that vision looks like. As a matter of fact, that's a part of my job is that clients walk into the office and they have some sort of a picture in mind. I don't know what that picture is, but they have some sort of a picture that if I ask the question, what will happen if you die, that something in their mind, a picture begins to create that says, well, my kids or the nonprofits that I leave things to, the family members I leave things to, whoever it is that will ultimately receive what you have, what I envision is that they will use it like this. And the unfortunate part is that a lot of legacy fulfillment is really not seen because oftentimes wills will be used. So that's just a check writing instrument. You can go back and listen to some of my heart about wills versus trusts. But even with trusts, documents are oftentimes rudimentarily created. And because they're not watched after, because they're not consistently updated, the opportunity to hand off exactly what the picture is in your mind to the next generation, or even to your spouse, which is where we're going to start, that if that picture does not perfectly align with the document, then legacy fulfillment is really, really tough. And I would unfortunately say that a lot of times the picture that we have doesn't exactly work out. Now, how do I know? Because I've talked to people and the documents that I have reviewed don't share or don't talk about exactly what they wanted. And so therefore, the document is inconsistent with the legacy fulfillment. So that's the whole purpose of this entire life cycle journey, of creating something that will fulfill our exact purpose and exactly what we have in store. And that doesn't matter, by the way, whether you have very little money or whether you have a lot of money. There is something that we need to do to fulfill your legacy and make sure that it comes to pass. So legacy fulfillment is really about, what handoff do we give to somebody, and is that handoff going to work exactly like we envision? And the only way that happens is that the documents align, the financial integration aligns, the continuing relationship aligns, and that the family is prepared. So this entire, again, this whole life cycle of estate planning is really geared towards this last piece, which is, is everything we're doing, does it meet the picture in your mind? Mm-hmm. And so we need to start here with two different ideas in legacy fulfillment. The first one is that if you are married, then it is statistically very, very small that you and your spouse will actually die at the same time. Right. So therefore, we need to make sure that when we hand things off to our spouse, that indeed that first picture is going to be fulfilled. So what is the picture that if we just handed things off to our spouse, that that would look like? For most people, it's not just making sure that we have money. Would it be that we have money that is protected? Would it be money that we make sure is created in a manner that would protect from Medicaid recapture or potential long-term illnesses? There's a myriad of things. Now, that goes all the way back up to the exploration and to the engage part, steps one and two. Mm. But if we don't have that done, then how do we hand it off in the surviving spouse? Now, what I really want to talk about here is, what does it mean to hand something off to a surviving spouse? And I want to talk about some of the pitfalls that I've seen as an estate planner, that even though it's going to the spouse, that somehow it's still missed. And so I want to start exploring a little bit about, what are some of the things we need to make sure we do right when we're married with our estate plan.
Right.
So spouse concerns. The first one, one of the biggest, is that oftentimes we have assets that are jointly created. So in other words, I'm married and I may have a bank account that has both my name and my spouse's name on it. Now, this is called a joint ownership, as we all understand. And by operation of law, so in other words, the law already says that if I die, then my wife automatically receives what is in that account. And oftentimes the bank accounts, maybe the financial institutions, maybe the IRAs, those accounts oftentimes get dealt with rather expediently. And in most cases, I see that they're actually done in a proper manner as far as removing the one who has died. We need to get their name off of the account. Mm. Because if we leave the name of the deceased spouse on, then we're going to set ourselves up that when the next person dies, that the kids or whoever is going to take over the account may need to almost go through a double probate, because we have to prove that both joint owners are now deceased.
Right.
So step one is that we need to make sure that we transfer things out of the decedent's name into the joint owner's name only. Now, one of the biggest assets that's missed is the home. So many times what will happen is we get the tax bill and we call the treasurer in the county and we say, oh, my husband died. So sorry, men, but I always have to have you die first in my story. So right. Now you've died first. So, so husband, you pass away. And so now the wife is calling, the treasurer at the county and saying, well, my spouse died. And so the tax bill should only come in my name. And the county, they very willingly and happily oblige. I'm sure that they say they're sorry and all this wonderful stuff. And they take the one who's deceased, they take their name off of the tax bill. However, the tax bill is not the legal ownership. The deed is the legal ownership. And I have watched over and over and over surviving spouses come to my office, and when we look up their deed, they are dumbfounded that their spouse's name, it's been years, sometimes 10 plus years since their spouse died, and they believe that they were the rightful owner of the home. No, I took care of that. Well, what they took care of was the tax bill. And so every year it only comes in the surviving spouse's name. And so they think that the decedent,
tax bill.
Yeah, the tax bill, but so they think that the decedent is off of the deed. But yet you have to go through the step of actually creating a new deed and signing it over, and there's multiple ways of doing that. It depends on whether...
What are the ramifications of that?
Yeah, and so it's the same ramifications. So good question. It's the same ramifications as anything, which is that if I go to sell the home, number one, my spouse's name is still on the deed. So now escrow may force me into a probate. Now, that doesn't happen all the time, so I don't want to pretend that this is always the case, but... I have watched it and to where escrow says, we're not going to title. So the title company says, we won't title it until the property has been re-deeded into just the surviving spouse's name. And they oftentimes will want a probate or some other mechanism in order to fulfill that need. Mm. And so years later, we could be opening up a probate. And let me tell you, that's not as easy as it sounds. No. So therefore, making sure that the decedent's name off the deed is really, really imperative. And here's the other thing. What if I lived in my home and then I die? Now my kids are supposed to be selling the home, and they're under the same problem, which is not just the one who just recently died, but now they have to go find all of the first decedent's information to make sure that we can close this out properly. Mm-hmm. So deeds are really one of the bigger things that we have to be watching for. You know, another thing of joint ownership that many times we don't think about is that we just simply take somebody's name off of an investment account, for example. But we neglect to ask for what's called a step-up in basis. So the step-up in basis, what that means is that if I bought Microsoft for $10 and I sold it for $100...
Stock.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I'd like to buy Microsoft for $10.
Right.
Yes, so the stock, then when I go to sell the stock at $100, that means I've made $90 for that one share of stock, and I have to pay capital gains on that. Well, if someone dies owning that stock, then the step up means that we can reassess the basis. In other words, what we purchased it for $100, so that if we sell it after they pass away, then we get the new tax ramifications, which if I sold it right away would virtually be zero, right? Because I sell it, right. Now it's worth $100 and I sell it for $100, no tax consequence. So oftentimes, surviving spouses, in their grief, forget or don't even know about the opportunity to get a step up in basis. And there can be a huge tax consequence for missing that step. So having things just in your joint name isn't a save-all. It actually needs to be properly taken care of in the settlement process to make sure all of these things are set up properly for the surviving spouse.
Yeah. Legacy fulfillment this week as we are into the last phases of the estate planning life cycle. Interesting information. If people are intrigued, they need help. How do they get in touch with you, Paul?
head over to legacyandfaith.com. You can sign up for our educational session. All of our past podcasts, including the Estate Planning Life Cycle, are there. And you can also shoot us an email, ask questions, make comments. We'd love to hear from you.
Okay, back with more of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant in just a moment.
Hi, this is Paul Grant with the Legacy and Faith Show. Thank you so much for listening. One of our core values at the Legacy and Faith Show is education, and education about proper estate planning. Well, we have more educational sessions coming up beginning in January. And on January 14th will be our first session of 2019. So you can join us whether in person or by live webinar on January 14th. Beginning at 6 p.m. You can go to legacyandfaith.com and sign up for this new educational program coming up. So again, go to legacyandfaith.com and sign up for our January 14th session.
Your photos, slides, scrapbooks, and home movies are invaluable and irreplaceable. Barry Kenny here with the Bear Services. Call us to save them as digital files to be stored electronically and shared liberally. We will even come to you so they stay in your possession. Go to thebearservices.com for more information. That's thebearservices.com.
We now return to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant, and continue today's practical discussion to apply biblical principles for kingdom purposes.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant, and wrapping up our very informative discussion of the estate planning life cycle and into legacy fulfillment, the final stages here, and how to make sure that surviving spouse is taken care of.
So we talked about some of the concerns that I see as an estate planner with jointly titled assets, not being able to take the name of the decedent off of jointly titled assets, specifically the home, potentially missing step-up and basises. And there's another tool that oftentimes estate planners will use, and it's called a testamentary trust. So what that means is that inside of a will, an attorney will stick a trust. And the whole purpose of that is that there will be an opportunity that if your estate is worth more than what the allotted amount is before an estate tax starts, that you can start the trust.
And what is that amount again?
So in Washington, it's just a tick below $2.2 million. As we enter into 2019, that'll be just a little bit over $2.2 million. Now, the federal level is $11.2 million, and that's per person. So for married couples, that's either $4.4 million or it's $22.4 million. But if the design is not properly created, and we don't have the potential trust in there to save on the taxes, then when the second spouse dies, because everything may have gone directly to the spouse through joint ownership or through a will, now a tax would incur and the estate would have to pay a tax before it is passed on to whether it's the next generation or charities or whoever else. So what happens in a testamentary trust is that the will then says, I want you to start a trust. Now, this is called typically, it's known as a disclaimer trust. So in other words, because everything is jointly titled, the surviving spouse actually has to make an election to say, I disclaim the use of this portion of the estate of my spouse. So let's say that the house is worth $500,000 and we need some of that to go into this disclaimer trust. So the surviving spouse would need to create a disclaimer, a legal disclaimer, upholdable by federal and state law, so that they, in other words, say, I won't use this in my name ever again, and I'm going to have it go to the trust. Well, there's many potential concerns I have with a disclaimer trust. First of all, it puts the proactive nature of this decision upon a grieving spouse.
Yeah.
This is a really, really tough place to be for a spouse. Number one, you just lost your partner, and now you have to remember all the different things that you're supposed to do, including making permanent financial elections instead of having the plan already created so that it happens naturally and already will protect you. And oftentimes, because the plans are created kind of like a one and done document, the surviving spouse doesn't understand why the attorney needs to do this. That kind of goes back up to the continuation commitment, which is constant education about the plan itself. So one of the bigger dangers I see in a surviving spouse is also that this disclaimer trust, or what we call as a Q-tip trust, is not properly created and sometimes never created. So a spouse dies in their 60s, all of a sudden in their 70s or 80s, we have much more money than we ever thought. And sometimes right. that happens, fortunately, and we wish we could have gone back in time, but we can't. So all of these things really, again, come back to the settlement system. But the whole part of legacy fulfillment is that unless all of these first seven steps work cooperatively, we can't have step number eight, the legacy fulfillment, actually work. And so if we miss any of the first seven, then number eight can't work. And yet it sounds so simple. Legacy fulfillment. Of course I want my legacy fulfilled. Well, then we need to be proactive in the estate planning life cycle.
Right.
So that kind of wraps up the surviving spouse concerns that I wanted to bring to the table and to listeners here today.
Okay.
So let's head on to the heir security for a little bit, and we'll wrap up our show here and wrap up this estate planning life cycle session.
So what do you mean by heir security?
So heir security is, again, we're under legacy fulfillment. So if we stop for a moment and said, how do I want what I have to be properly used or utilized or preserved for the use of whoever that is? So let's call it our children, okay, for lack of better terminology. Again, I understand that this could also be for nonprofits. It could also be for other family members. So when I say children, I mean collectively whoever you're leaving things to. But let's just focus on children for a second. Now, in my experience, and I've mentioned this many times on different shows, which is that the natural instinct of receiving free money is that we like to spend it.
Right. The lottery mentality.
Yep, that's exactly correct. And as statistics show that 80% of lottery winners go to bankruptcy. And so the bankruptcy road starts because it's free money. It starts with the mentality that I didn't have to use my blood, sweat, and tears to save this up for the preservation of what my needs are. And unfortunately, wealth, when it's transferred from family members, the same characteristics as the lottery winner begin to rear their heads. The average inheritance is spent within 18 months after death.
No matter how big it is.
That's correct.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that's right. 18 months. And six of those are typically probate, if not more. So if we take away those first 6 months of that they don't even have access, that's in less than 12 months, the average inheritor has spent it all. And yes, I've told other stories about someone inheriting $1.5 million and in less than a year has spent it all and literally has nothing to show for it. They didn't pay off their house. They didn't invest any. They didn't try to use it for long-term retirement needs, nothing. Now, if we could bring back the parent, do you think that they would be happy with that? And I would have to say that with my clients and what I have learned is that the answer is no. And so heir security is really about, have we educated and have we brought the family into it, which is, again, the family reception part of step number five in this life cycle. Are they ready? And if they are, then how do they leverage and utilize their inheritance in a proper way? Now, if we utilize a trust, they need to be taught how to leverage and use a trust to their greatest advantage. Do you know that we can use a trust for a tax advantage? I know that actually you may have heard exactly the opposite, which is that taxes in a trust are worse or higher. Well, that can be true if the trust is not maintained properly. But with a really good accountant and with the heirs being involved in heir security process, then we can actually leverage a trust account for better tax leverage than it is bad tax issues. So that is necessary. Without proper education and without the heirs remaining in their continual commitment after the fact, then we may begin to transfer things into our own personal name, which means it's subject to divorces, which means it's subject to our debtors, or if we were in a car accident. Everything that I've talked about on this show in previous times about the benefits of possibly using a trust, the heirs need to be brought up to speed. Mm. And eventually, this life cycle, the circle of it, is that the heirs need to be encouraged to enter into step number one at this point. They need to start the exploration and education and engage and create in their own estate planning. So as we hand off to the next generation, is their estate ready? And can they take on the same family legacy that says, I am going to be blessed, and I want to be a blessing to my next generation. And so we need to encourage that this entire life cycle actually restarts again. And that's the estate planning life cycle.
The estate planning life cycle, all eight ideas have been communicated over a number of weeks here, a number of shows, all of those still available at legacyandfaith.com. People have been intrigued, though, with maybe even just even today's show, and they need help. They know they need you to design an estate for them. How do they get in touch with you, Paul?
Head over to our website, legacyandfaith.com, and click on the education buttons, or there's communication options as well. So legacyandfaith.com.
Legacyandfaith.com. Always great stuff. The Legacy and Faith Show with estate and tax planning attorney Paul Grant here on KCIS.
Thank you for joining us for the Legacy and Faith Show. You can find more information about the show and Paul Grant at legacyandfaith.com. Join us next week at the same time as we learn to build God's kingdom and continue our journey on how to protect wealth and family values for generations. All discussions on the Legacy and Faith Show are intended to be about general legal issues. If a situation applies to you, then we encourage you to seek specific legal advice. Please do not rely upon any discussions from this program in place of having a personal relationship with your attorney. Any listener question that may have been answered also does not constitute legal advice and does not establish a client-attorney relationship.